So we'll start. So welcome to the first class of the CJE course. Officially, this course should take us 2 years, so we've got a while to go.
What is this course?
So I'll explain. So first of all, let's discuss that for a few minutes, what the objective of what we're trying to do here. The objective of this idea, which we called CJE, which stands for Course Jewish Essentials, Course of Jewish Essentials, is basically to get to know the basics of Judaism in an in-depth way, right? So basically to, you know, we all know the words, there's one God, or the word Torah, or the word bar mitzvah, or wedding, etc., etc. But we have to get to really know them, right? And there's a lot of things which we know. We know the words. We don't necessarily really know them. So the purpose over here is to get to know what we already know, and of course to learn new things as well. So that's the objective here. The way we structured this is that there's eight modules or eight terms of this course. We'll just quickly go through them. This term, we're calling it foundations. We'll get into in a second what that is all about. The second term is Jewish learning, development of Jewish law. For example, how we have all the prohibitions of Shabbos, the way they look today. You know, how did we get from the Chumash to the way they are? And we have term three will be about Jewish life cycle. So starting from birth, bris, bar mitzvah, bas mitzvah, wedding, etc., etc. The fourth part will be about Jewish history. So starting from all the way from the beginning, all the way to the modern state of Israel. The fifth part will be about prayer and shul, synagogue. So we'll go through everything we need to know about that. The sixth part is about famous Jewish personalities, King David, King Solomon, from then on until today. Part seven will be about the Jewish calendar, so the Jewish year, all the festivals, the week, you know, Shabbos, etc. And number eight, the final one, will be going through the Jewish day. So from waking up till we go to sleep, what a Jewish day is supposed to look like. So each one of these eight parts are divided into their own parts, which is basically what we're going to do throughout the first term. Every week is going to be a different part of it. So let's just go through the first one, the one in which we're going to discuss this term. So we're calling this one foundations. What it is to explore and to try and understand the foundations of what Judaism is built on. So tonight we're going to discuss the foundations of monotheism. We'll see soon what that means. Next week we'll discuss the idea of Torah from Sinai, the idea that Torah is divine, it's not man-made. We'll discuss reward and punishment, free choice, prophecy, the messianic revelation, Mashiach, etc., etc. And we'll discuss each of these in try as much detail as we can, and also to try and discuss why these things are a foundation, which is what we're calling it, foundations. Why, you know, everything else we're going to discuss, all the other seven, are all details. Right? You have the various festivals, various Jewish personalities, various Jewish customs, all these things are all details within Judaism. This term is very important and essential because we're going to go through the very foundations of what our religion is based on. That means without what we have, without what we're going to discuss, there is no Judaism, right? If somebody doesn't keep a specific commandment, okay, you know, everyone's on their own journey, etc. You know, not everyone's expected to keep everything. We try our best, but that doesn't mean that you've destroyed Judaism. If you take away anything that we're going to discuss within the next few weeks, you've basically taken out the foundation of Judaism and the whole thing crumbles. And we'll, as we go through each one, we'll discuss why that is the case. Some, of course, will be more obvious than the others, but we'll try and understand as much as we can. The foundations which we're going to discuss, is based upon what Maimonides calls the 13 principles of faith, which basically encompasses everything that we mentioned, the idea of monotheism, the idea of reward and punishment, the idea of free choice, idea of prophecy, the messianic revelation, all of these things are the 13 principles of faith. So what I want to do, and tonight, we'll discuss basically the first five. The first five all are centered around God and monotheism and all that entails. Just to explain to you what you have in front of you, so you have a folder which you can keep and bring back every time. And every week I'll give you another plastic sleeve with there's two things in there. One of them is just a sort of in brief what we're going to discuss. And the other one is a source sheet. Now the source sheet is pretty thick, and we're only here for an hour, so we're not going to go through all of it. But the reason why I put a lot of these sources in full is that if you want to, in your own time, just to read through and see the way they are in full. But basically, we'll try and read what's in bold, and that's really what I want to focus on tonight. So let's have a look at source number one. You have it? You have two booklets. One of them is just the sheer outline, and one is a source sheet. So in source number one, I have over here just a brief list, very in brief, of the 13 principles of faith. I'm going to go through tonight, just read through the first five. Let's just read it through. This is basically a very in brief translation, because Maimonides, the Rambam, goes through each one in great detail, like we'll try and do. But what we have in front of you is I got it from Chabad.org. They just translated it in a very, very brief way. So let's read through the first five, get the words straight, and then we'll try and examine what it actually means. So number one is the belief in the existence of the Creator, who is perfect in every manner of existence and is the primary cause of all that exists. So that means what it means, that we have to believe in the existence that there is a God, basically, who created the world, who is 100% perfect, doesn't lack anything, and he is the primary cause of all that exists. He created all of existence. That's number one. Number two, the belief in God's absolute and unparalleled unity. Okay, we'll understand what that means soon. Number three, the belief that in God's, the fact that he has no bodily aspects to him, he's not affected by any physical occurrences, such as movement or rest or dwelling, all of these things. Anything physical doesn't apply to God. Number four, the belief in God's eternity, that God is eternal, he exists forever. And number five, the fact that we are commanded to only worship God exclusively and no other false gods. So these are the first five of the 13 principles of faith, and basically that encompasses what it means, monotheism. So let's get right into it and see what this all means. So they say a story about a religious believer who was telling off an atheist, you know, how can you not believe in God, right? What kind of life do you have? What kind of meaning do you have? Right? How can it be that you don't believe in God? The atheist calmly listens, and he answers, you know, I don't understand the big deal. Over history, there have been 10,000 gods throughout history. You reject 9,999 of them. I just reject one more. Right? So that's, you know, well, what's the big deal, you know? Right. Which, it's a joke, but that's the way we understand monotheism in a very basic level, that we believe that there's only one God. Right? We believe that there is a God, and we believe that there's only one God. But what does that actually mean, that there's one God? You know, we say that almost four times a day, could be, right? When we say Shema in the morning and night, and then, you know, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elikeinu, Hashem Echad, Hero Israel, God is God and God is one. What does it actually mean that there's one God? And in fact, let us ask a better question. What does it actually mean, God? When we say the word God, what do we mean by that? Right? Sometimes we say something so often, we don't even think what it means, right? What do we mean when we say God? And when we understand what we mean when we say God, we'll understand what we mean, that there's only one God. Right? So, God is another way of saying infinite existence, or better said, undefined existence. Everything else besides for God is defined, has a very specific definition, both physical and spiritual. So This table is very defined. It's defined in its space that it takes up. It's defined in what it is. It defines in what it serves, what purpose it serves. It's very defined in what color it is. It has a lot of it's very specifically defined. And that doesn't only apply to physical existences, but also applies to spiritual existence. For example, an emotion of kindness, right? That's a spiritual existence. That's not something you can touch, right? There's something called kindness, an emotion. Or a logical explanation of something, right? That's a spiritual existence. That's not a physical existence. All of those things are very defined. Logic is not emotion. Emotion is not logic. Kindness is not anger. Anger is not kindness. Right? So all of these things are very, very specifically defined. Physically, everything has its physical space. And spiritually, everything has its spiritual space. Meaning, logic only exists in the world of logic. And that's it. In emotion, logic doesn't exist. In logic, emotion doesn't exist. Everything has its specific space, its specific definition, its limitation to what it is and what it isn't. Right, that's every single existence until you come to God. And in fact, even the description infinite, in other words, something which is just infinite, that itself is also a definition. Because you're defining it by being infinite. It's infinite and not finite. Right? It's spiritual, not physical. It's physical, not spiritual. Everything is defined in what it is, and it isn't something else. Right? Saying that something isn't something else is another way of saying that it's defined exactly in what it is. The only existence which is undefined is God. God is another way of saying undefined existence. He is truly infinite. In other words, not defined as infinite, but he's really infinite. He is not anything, and he is everything. That's the expression which is used. You cannot define him as anything specific, but he's everything. He can be anything, he is everything, he encompasses everything, but he's not anything. He can't be defined as anything specific. Now, obviously that's not something we can really comprehend, right? Because, you know, in our world, every existence has a definition. So if I tell you, you know, in the other room, there's an existence there, right? The first question you're going to ask me is, what is that existence? Define it for me, explain it to me, whether it's physical or spiritual, right? Having an existence which is undefined, which cannot be defined as anything, is something which is not in our world at all. It's not our type of existence. It's not our type of being. Right? Our being is being in something, with something, defined by something. God is undefined. That is God. Right. Now, I haven't explained anything to you. I just said God is undefined, right? Because you can't explain what God is. God is inexplainable. But just giving you a little bit of at least some words to say, right? That God is an existence. He is true existence, not bound by anything. Every other existence is bound by what it is. A table is bound by being a table, not a chair. It's not true existence. It's only existence in what it is and not in anything else. Spiritual existence is the same way. God is true and the ultimate existence, which exists in everything but can't be defined by anything. That's what we mean when we say the word God. Now that we have that definition, right, quote unquote, of what God is, now we need to ask ourselves the question, is it possible for there to be two of these gods? What do you think? Yeah, we know that there's one God. But the question is it possible to, once I've just explained to you that this is what we mean when we say God, is it possible to have two of such existences?
No, because we don't know what the first one is. Because the first one is God, it's not defined.
Okay, so let me take what you're saying a little bit of a step further. When you have number one and you have number two of anything, so you have two tables in the room, what makes it that there's not one table but two? Because the one table ended and the second table started. Right? So therefore, there's room for a second table. Right? That's only because the table is defined in a certain space. Because this table only exists with these measurements, doesn't exist anywhere else. Right? So therefore, there could be another table, because there's an end point where something else can begin. There is no end to God. Because God is undefined, there's no end to him. What ends him? Only something with a definition ends. As we said, logic ends where emotion starts. Right? In the world of emotion, logic doesn't say anything. You know, when someone's emotional, you could tell them logic from today to tomorrow, but they're emotional. Right? And the same thing is if someone is purely logical, you could tell them emotion from today to tomorrow and I won't talk to them. Why? Because in the world of logic, emotion doesn't exist. Because logic is defined as being logic. Where logic ends, emotion starts. Where this table ends, the next table starts. But God has no definition. God has nothing to end. Right? It's like, what exactly ends? Yeah? Making sense? Yeah? There's nothing to end. There's no area outside of him. What's not him? As I said, he is everything and is not defined by anything. So where is the outside of him? Therefore, once you just understand the simple meaning of what you say, the word God, what you're really saying is one God. It goes hand in hand. There cannot be two undefined existences. It's just impossible. It doesn't. The two words are contradiction. What makes things two is their definition. What makes something different from something else is this has this definition and this has this definition. This is defined as this, this is defined as that. But something that's undefined, so there can't be another undefined thing. It's what's going to differentiate between the two? It's going to be the same thing. They're both undefined. So it's really one existence. It's all one. Right? So therefore, when we say the word God, what we mean is one God. So of course there's only one God. Going back to the source, which we saw the 13 principles of faith, if you read now the first two, the second is a direct result of the first. Belief in the existence of the Creator, who is perfect in every manner of existence. What does he mean by that? Is perfect in every manner of existence. What we mean by that is that he is everything. There is nothing outside of him. There's nothing outside of his definition, and he can't be defined as anything. And therefore, number two is obvious. The belief in God's absolute and unparalleled unity. Once you understand number one, the belief in one God, number two is obvious. Number two is a direct result of that. Yeah? Making sense? Just to point out that this term will be slightly more philosophical, because that's what all these things are. We're talking about monotheism and free choice. I mean, we're dealing with philosophy. As we go on to the other things, we'll get more, at least a little bit more technical. Now, the Rambam over there, where he discusses these things at length, he explains, what does it mean, one God? He says, it doesn't only mean one God, that there's no other God. He says that God within himself is one, meaning everything else has different parts to it. Right? I have arms and legs and a head. Right? There's no parts of God. Again, something which we cannot understand. To us, every existence has parts, has different either physical parts or even spiritual parts. Even a spiritual existence has different levels, different aspects to it. Right? To know of an existence that's just one, without any parts, is something that's hard for us to understand. But according to what we explained before, it is understood that it is that way. Because again, only something which is defined can have parts. Parts means that it's very defined. My leg is my leg, my arm is my arm, my head is my head. Right? All these things are very specific in what they are. Right? But if you're talking about an undefined existence, an infinite existence, so there can't be any parts to it. It's just one existence that's just made up of existence. Right? No definition. Right? Also, number three is obvious. Right, the fact that he's not affected by any physical occurrences, again, all these things, being affected by something physical, sitting, standing, you know, movement, rest, well, all these things are only possible when we're talking about a limited, finite, either human being or existence, can be affected by such things. When we're talking about someone who's infinite and undefined, all of these things have no place at all. Once you know all of these things, it is obvious that God is eternal. And that's number four. The belief in God's eternity. right? The fact that something ends, eternal doesn't only mean, eternal means in time, eternal means in space, right? Because, again, something who is, someone who is undefined doesn't end. There's no end. An end is its, a being's end, an existence end is its definition, right? What ends a table is the fact that it's not a chair. What ends logic is the fact that it's not emotion. God has no end, not in time, and not in space, not in concept, nowhere, because he's truly infinite, he is everything, and again, not defined by anything. So that's the first four. However, the Rambam goes a step further, and he says, number five, that only to this God we should serve and pray, right? And no other false gods. And the truth is, what the Rambam is saying here is actually taking this whole monotheism concept to a whole new step and really tells us what monotheism, Jewish monotheism, is really all about. But to understand that, let's take a step back from the philosophy of monotheism and let's discuss a little bit the history of monotheism. Who discovered it and how he discovered it and from who he discovered it. So let's read this inside in, again, the Rambam's words. So it's source number two. Just to give you a little bit of context where this is written. So the Rambam, Maimonides, is obviously one of the greatest Torah scholars in history, right? And a lot of these things, and the reason why I'm quoting him so much, a lot of these things, the foundations of Judaism is from him. And he defined them very well. But he has many books, many works. The one which we quoted before is the 30 Principles of Faith, but now we're going to quote from a different book, which is called Mishnah Torah. Mishnah Torah is what's loosely referred to as Rambam. When someone says the Rambam, they're referring to this book. And that is basically what the Rambam did. He was the first one to codify Jewish law. We have today what's called the Shulchan Aruch. When we get to the development of Jewish learning, we'll discuss this more in detail. But that's the code of the Jewish the code of Jewish law. Everything in very order, do this, don't do that. Right? The Rambam was the first one to do that, to gather all of Jewish knowledge from the entire Talmud, from the entire Torah, and make it very in order, chapters, you know, paragraphs, exactly what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do. In the laws of idol worship, where the Rambam speaks about the laws of idol worship, he goes through in the first chapter a whole history lesson. Very interesting, and the Rambam is not a history book. That book, it's a book of law. And obviously that he's telling us this history, it must be important to understand what does it mean not to serve idols? What does it really mean that there's one God? So it's very long, and we're not going to read all of it. We'll just read the parts which I put in bold. So of course, when God first created man, Adam and Chava, the first man and woman, they obviously recognized God, right? Because they were created by God. However, within a few generations, God had been totally forgotten. By the time Abraham came around, the entire world served idols, and no one knew who God was at all. The whole existence of God was hidden. Right? How did that happen? How did we go from Adam and Eve knowing that there's one God, not serving idols, you know, the complete faith in one God, to the time right before Abraham came around where God had been absolutely forgotten? How did we, within, you know, 2,000 years, let's say, go from that? Right? And the Rambam explains how they got there. So he says like this. Their mistake was as follows. And this is obviously a translation. This is not the original. The original is in Hebrew. This is a translation. Their mistake was as follows. Again, taken just for honesty's sake. It's taken from Chabad.org. They said God created stars and spheres with which to control the world. He placed them on high and treated them with honor, making them servants who minister before him. Accordingly, this is what they understood, it is fitting to praise and glorify them and to treat them with honor. They perceived this to be the will of God, blessed be he, that they magnify and honor those whom he magnified and honored. Just as a king desires that the servants who stand before him be honored. Indeed, doing so is an expression of honor to the king. Right. After conceiving of this notion, they began to construct temples to the stars and offer sacrifices to them. They would praise and glorify them with words and prostrate themselves before them, because by doing so, they would, according to their false conception, be fulfilling the will of God. Right. Now, then he goes, and he says that years passed, and false prophets came and said that this star spoke to me and said that you should pray to me, and this rock spoke to me, and etc., until they totally forgot the original God, and they just served all of these suns, moons, and stars, and all the and idols, etc. Skip, I think, two pages. Yeah, go to the next bold part, and here he's speaking about Abraham. He said that all of this went on until Abraham came around. He says after this mighty man, he calls Abraham mighty man, was weaned, in other words, approximately 3 years old, he began to explore and think. Though he was a child, he began to think throughout the day and night, wondering, how is it possible for the sphere to continue to revolve without having anyone controlling it? Who is causing it to revolve? Surely it does not cause itself to revolve. He had no teacher, nor was there anyone to inform him. Rather, he was mired in Urkastim among the foolish idolaters. His father, mother, and all the people around him were idol worshippers, and he would worship with them. However, his heart was exploring and gaining understanding. Ultimately, he appreciated the way of truth and understood the path of righteousness through his accurate comprehension. He realized that there was one God who controlled the sphere, that he created everything, and that there is no other God among all other entities. He knew that the entire world was making a mistake. What caused them to err was their service of their stars and images, which made them lose awareness of the truth. Now again, he goes on to say how old Abraham was, and then he goes on to say that, in fact, Abraham started a new religion, basically, Judaism, and his descendants continued in his ways until they went to Egypt. And when they went to Egypt, they too started to serve idols. And he said that it almost happened that what Abraham discovered was lost, had it not been that God, in his great mercy, took the Jewish people out and made us a nation and took us to Mount Sinai and revealed himself to us over there. All right. That's the history of monotheism. The one who discovered it, really, or should I say rediscovered it, Abraham, who rediscovered the truth that Adam and Eve knew after so many generations of people losing it and totally forgetting where it all came from. So just to, again, summarize what the Rambam wants to bring out over here is that the first mistake that they made was not that there's another God. That wasn't their mistake. Their first mistake was that God, by creating all these things, the sun, the moon, and the stars, gave honor to them, gave some sort of power to the sun, or power to the stars, power to the rain. In other words, nature, they understood, had some sort of power and importance to it. Right? And therefore they thought, well, if God gave it importance, then we should give it importance, and we should bring sacrifices to the sun, sacrifices to the moon. Eventually, that led them to forgetting the one who created all of these things, right? Who's the original source of everything, and they just started serving these things. They started serving nature, sun, moon, stars, stones, etc. Right? What was their mistake? Their mistake was, the beginning of their mistake was that they didn't understand the way God uses nature. God did not appoint the sun and give it powers to give light to the world. God did not give rain the power to make things grow. God is merely using them as a tool. The sun is not shining light. God is, through the sun. It's a very big difference. A good example which is brought, in Hebrew it's called kegarzon biyad hachoitzev, which means like an axe in the hands of a woodchopper. The axe has no power whatsoever. The axe does not choose whether to chop down the tree or not. The axe by its own wouldn't be able to chop down a tree. The axe is merely a tool with which the woodchopper chops down the tree. And the truth is that's the way we're supposed to look at nature. And that was their mistake, that they didn't look at nature this way. We're supposed to look at the sun and the moon and the stars and all the forces of nature. They are merely tools with which God gives sustenance to the world. God is the one who gives light. God is the one who makes grass grow, not rain. It's through the rain. He uses the rain. It's merely a tool. It's unimportant. Meaning unimportant in terms of, it's unimportant that we don't pray to rain. We don't pray to the sun, the moon, and the stars, because they have no power. It's like an axe. It's like, no one will go and say, wow, the axe did a good job chopping down the tree. You don't say that, right? You say, oh, this must have been a good wood chopper. Why do you say that? Because the axe has no power. It's the wood chopper's skill using the axe to chop down the tree. Right? And that's the way we're supposed to perceive nature. And since they didn't perceive nature that way, they gave importance to something else besides for God, sun, the moon, and the stars, that then led them to the mistake that they're supposed to pray to the sun, the moon, and the stars, which eventually led them to the mistake that they forgot about God altogether and just served idols. So the Rambam, through giving us the history, it's not just history, it's an understanding of what true monotheism means and what Abraham truly discovered. Abraham, which is number 5 on the 13 principles of faith, going back to source number 1. Right, after we understand that there's a God and he's one and he's not affected by anything physical and that is eternal, number 5 is the imperative to worship God exclusively and no foreign false gods. Because this is actually a step further than everything we learned till now. Everything we learned till now was talking about God himself. God himself is one, okay? That doesn't mean they didn't give power to the sun. Number 5 is taking it a step further. Number 5 is saying, besides the fact that God himself is one, and God is eternal, and he's not affected by anything physical, and he's infinite, and he's everything, and not defined by anything. Besides for that, nothing else ever took on any importance besides for him. Even after God created the sun, even after God created the moon and the stars and the rain, etc., he never gave them powers whatsoever. They were merely tools with which God uses to give sustenance to the world. Yeah? All making sense so far? Yeah. If you have, if you want to argue, please feel free. I love a good argument. Okay. So to summarize what we know till now. We know that there's only one God, right? And we know that saying the word God and one is synonymous. We know that he's the only power. And this basically encompasses the first 5 of the 13 principles of faith. Okay. Now, let's get into a different part of all of this. How do we know that this is all true? So far, I've given you facts. The fact that there's a God. Okay, I've given you a definition of what that means, that he's undefined. The fact that he's one. The fact that he never gave any power to anything else. How do I know that all of this is true? From where do Jews know this? Right. So we saw a little bit in the Rambam how Abraham discovered this, but I want to get into this a little bit more. And before I get into how do we prove this, let's first examine, do we need to understand? Do we need to prove it? In other words, what is our beliefs based on? Is it based on that we can prove it, or is it belief? Right. Which one is it? Do we believe in God, or do we know God? Do we know that God exists, or do we believe that God exists? And the answer is, in a typical Jewish way, is that they're both true. We believe in God, and we know God. And that's where we come to source 3, again from the Rambam, quoting a lot from the Rambam today. Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
Number 5, this is always troubled. Why it says the imperative to worship God, but why mention the issue of exclusivity and no foreign false gods? Because that, as a matter of fact, there is none. So why mention that there would be?
Yeah. So I think what we said before might answer that question. It's a good question. Because we're not talking about necessarily another God. First of all, it's the simple way to learn it is that it's saying that there's no other God. That's the simple way to learn. In other words, it's saying don't serve any other God because there is none. Don't serve any other fake God. Right? In other words, it's saying even though it's fake, I'm still prohibiting you from serving it. Right? Even though it's really non-existent. Right? That's a simple way of understanding it. But before we gave a little bit of more of a deeper understanding, that it doesn't necessarily only mean foreign gods in terms of you know, the supreme being, but he means foreign powers. The sun exists, right? The moon exists. That's a true existence, right? But we're saying, don't make them a god. Don't ascribe to them powers that they don't have. Right? Does that? Okay, so in source number 3, let's find it. There you go. It's from the Rambam. Now, there's two sources here, and I put them on the one source because both bring out one point. One of them is from the Sefer HaMitzvahs. Sefer HaMitzvahs is where the Rambam very briefly just summarizes the 630 mitzvahs. And the second paragraph over here is from the Mishneh Torah, which is, again, the compilation which I mentioned before, where he goes into great detail, all the Jewish law, basically everything. So in Sefer HaMitzvahs, he says, positive commandment number 1, Onoichi Hashem Elekecha. Those words come from the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God. The very first mitzvah, says Maimonides, is to believe in God, a primal entity that is the cause and origin of all that exists. So he uses the word believe. In the second paragraph over here, this is from Mishneh Torah, and this is where the Rambam is going into great detail about this first mitzvah, but he changes his terminology. He says, the foundation of all foundations and the pillar of wisdom is to know that there is a primary being who brought into being all existence. So he says to know. He doesn't say to believe, he says to know. So which one is it? Is it to know or to believe? And the answer is that it's both. We need to know and we need to believe. And the obvious question is why? If I believe, why do I need to know? If I know, why do I need to believe? Right. And the answer is that faith is deeper, but it's subconscious. It's harder to actually live with on a practical level. Knowing, knowledge, is more external. It's less deep in me, but it's more conscious. I can actually live with it on a day-to-day life. And without getting too involved in this, the difference between belief and knowledge is, why does a Jew believe? Right? You can't tell someone to believe. That's just a contradiction in terms, right? If you believe, you believe. You don't believe, you don't believe. But I believe that every Jew believes. That's part of my belief. I believe that every Jew, whether they know it or not, believes in God, right? Why does every Jew believe in God? Because every Jew has a soul, and that soul is a part of God. That soul is godliness. And therefore, just like you know, or you know beyond knowledge, that you're here. I don't have to prove to you that you're here. You just know that you're here. You have just an awareness of your own existence, right? So too, you know that God exists. You believe that God exists. Belief meaning, I don't need to prove it to you. I don't need to prove to you that you're here because you're you. So you know that you're here. And I don't need to prove to you that God exists because you have a piece of God within you. That's why a Jew believes. That's where belief comes from. In other words, belief comes from a very deep part of a person. It comes from who we are in our essence. However, a lot of times, that belief doesn't express itself on a conscious, revealed level. And that's the famous classic case in the Talmud, that it says that a robber, a thief, before he goes into the house to steal, he prays to God to be successful. Right? So, he believes in God, obviously, because he's praying to God, but he's doing something against God at the same second. How does that work? Because belief is very deep, but it doesn't necessarily express itself in my actions. People can believe a lot of things, but it's very abstract and doesn't necessarily affect the way I am practically. What affects the way I am practically a lot more is when I truly understand something. When I truly understand something, my mind comprehends it, that becomes a part of who I am on a conscious level. So therefore, a Jew needs both. First of all, a Jew needs to believe in God, whether we understand it or not. Whether we can prove it or not, we don't need a proof. Jews don't need a proof to believe in God, we just do. Why? Because we have a part of God within us. However, the problem with just believing in God is that won't necessarily change the way I live. Right? What will change the way I live is if I study and I learn and I try to understand it on an intellectual level. When I can actually prove it to myself, then I'm more comfortable with it on a conscious, revealed level. Right? So what's the proof that God exists, right? That's the, you know, famous question. Everyone asks the question, how do I know God exists, right? So besides for the belief that I have, of course. So there's a fascinating, fascinating letter. And this is something I always come back to when I discuss this with people. This is a letter from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who, besides for being a giant in Torah and Judaism, also was a giant in science. And he, you know, he, in other words, he was able to sort of express himself in scientific terms because he studied in university and was able to, he studied engineering, and he knew very scientific terms. And this letter, you just see, I mean, besides for the Rebbe's righteousness and everything of that, you just see the Rebbe's deep intellect, just deep, very, very, his depth in what he's trying to bring across here. And this is a letter written to somebody by the name of Mr. Yitzchak Damiel. This person, I believe he was Israeli, and he led a youth group of teenagers. And the teenagers asked him a question: can you prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that there's a God? Just once and for all, let's put the matter to rest. Can you prove it beyond the shadow of a doubt that nobody can refute it? And he obviously didn't have a good answer, so he turned this question to the Rebbe. And the Rebbe answered him with a very lengthy letter. I brought the whole letter here for you to read on your own if you want to. It's deep, and it's lengthy, and it's complicated. But the first thing that, which I'm not going to read inside, but the first thing which the Rebbe does is goes into the question. What do you mean by absolute proof? Because in fact, there's no absolute proof for anything. Anything you can say, maybe not. You can't prove anything. How do I know, for example, that anything in history happened? Well, I know because people told me. Maybe they're lying. Maybe. It's a possibility. I mean, it's probably not, right? I believe World War I happened. Why? Because I was told. Is it possible that everyone made it up? It's possible. It is. There's a possibility, right? I mean, it's very unlikely, but it's a possibility. Nevertheless, I accept it as a fact that World War I happened, right? Why? Because although it's not beyond the shadow of a doubt 100%, but I consider it 100%. In our terminology, in other words, within the boundaries of logic itself, that is 100%. And the Rebbe goes and brings one proof, which we're not going to get into today, because I want to discuss that more. I'm going to bring this letter again when we discuss Torah from Sinai. But the revelation at Sinai is a proof of God's existence in terms of the fact that we know that that story happened, it's passed on from generation to generation. But I want to bring his second proof. So if you skip a couple of pages, the bold. The paragraph starts, there is a second manner of proof. I'm not sure if I'm going to read the whole thing that I put in bold here. It's quite lengthy, but...
Sorry, that section is that,
sorry? So it's, skip a few pages. There is a second manner of proof. So keep on turning. It's the bold. It's quite a few pages. Quite a long letter. Yeah. Okay. So there is a second manner of proof. Now, I must say, but this is also a translation which I took from Chabad.org. Although I have seen the original Hebrew letter, they haven't translated word for word. There are a few changes here, so really the best thing is to see in the original Hebrew, if you understand Hebrew, but they did a pretty accurate job, but they have changed a few things, I guess, for the right reasons. I mean, it's hard to translate Hebrew exactly, and they made it more readable, but it's not an exact, just for the sake of honesty, it's not a 100% exact translation. So there is a second manner of proof, which is also based on the premise above, that everything that happens has a cause, that seeing any event or situation is proof positive that some guiding force exists, even if the event was apparently senseless or destructive. This proof, so it's based on the premise that everyone accepts. Can I prove this premise 100%? No, but it's a premise which everyone accepts, that every effect has a cause. When I see something happen, something must have caused it. So he says, consider any object. Virtually anything that one can imagine is composed of various parts that are arranged and coordinated with remarkable precision. None of the parts has any inherent control over the other. And yet, we know that the harmonious and unified functioning of the entire system is itself a phenomenon and must be due to some cause. We conclude from this with complete confidence that there is an external power that binds and unifies all the parts. Moreover, the very fact that it binds and unifies the parts proves that it is stronger than they are, this might be a mistake, since it controls them. Okay, and he brings an example. For example, If we were to enter a factory where everything was run automatically and we did not see anyone there, we would not doubt the existence and involvement of a great mechanic whose knowledge encompassed all the machinery and component parts and who controlled them. One who was in charge of their functioning among themselves and who maintained the connection between the parts and the control center. On the contrary, the more concealed the hand of man in such a factory, and the more the operations are automated, the more impressed and convinced we are of the mechanic's remarkable skill. It's a very, very, very deep point there. And if this is the case with a factory, when we are speaking of hundreds, thousands, or even tens of thousands of parts, how much more true is this for natural objects? Example, a piece of wood or stone, a plant or an animal, and needless to say, the structure of the human body, as Job states, from my flesh I will envision God. This is especially so from the scientific perspective that every object is comprised of billions of atoms. Billions. With each atom containing even more minute parts. One would think at first glance that chaos would reign and yield incomparable disorder. When you have billions of parts coming together, how does it all fit exactly together? But instead, we see an amazing orderliness and a marvelous fitting of the smaller parts to the larger, up to the very largest, as well as the integration of microcosmic and macrocosmic patterns and processes, etc., etc. It is therefore clear beyond any shadow of a doubt that there exists a mechanic responsible for all of this. Now, what's the first reaction everyone has when you hear this? That this is all nature. Who says that means there's a God? This is all the laws of nature. The fact that everything works so well together. You know, I just recently had a baby, right? The fact that a baby is conceived and born is just when you think about it, I'm not a scientist and I'm not a doctor, so I don't even know how it really works, right? But just even my very basic knowledge, and just for everything to work is a miracle, is literally a miracle, right? The fact that it actually ends up that way, right? A human being comes out. But you can say it's laws of nature. That's what nature dictates, that when this happens and forms into a human being. So he explains like this. This is another deep point. Point number two, he says. One might say that all this is governed according to the laws of nature. But I think it is important to emphasize that such expressions have no explanatory content, but rather give a convenient summary or description of the existing situation. Meaning, nature is not an explanation. Nature is a description. When I say that when the rain falls and grass grows, that's the laws of nature, I haven't explained to you how that happens. I've given you a description, and I'm calling it nature. It's nature that when rain falls, the grass grows. That's not an explanation. Giving it a name, calling it nature, is just another way of describing the way the world works. The world works according to the laws of nature. But that's not an explanation. How do the laws of nature work? How does nature work so perfectly? How, when rain falls, does grass grow? I don't know. That's just the laws of nature, right? That's not an explanation. That's just a description. That's what he says. There's no explanatory content, but rather give a convenient summary or description of the existing situation, right? But to say that a law of nature is a being in of itself without dependence, and that this being rules throughout the cosmos, and there are thousands of beings like it, according to the number of natural laws, is so absurd that there was not one scientist in the field who would say so. Again, I'm just reading what he says, I'm not a scientist. Rather, it is the case that such laws are merely convenient summary expressions for describing a situation, so that one should not be forced to duplicate at every turn a lengthy description of the simple facts. In other words, when I want to describe to you how a baby's born, so I can give you a 5-hour course exactly how it works, right? But just an easier way of doing it is say that's what laws of nature does. Laws of nature dictates that when this happens, and this happens, the baby's born. Instead of me giving you all the details of everything, when I want to describe to you how a rain falls, grass grows, instead of me giving you 17 scientific terms and how it works, I just say nature. It's just a briefer summary of what's happening, not an explanation of what's happening. The explanation of what's happening is, as he says over here, is the mechanic, who we call God. Right? Now, this seems to be a very simplistic way of thinking. And I'm not going to read it to you, but if you read on, he goes on to say that he understands it sounds very simplistic, And sometimes, you know, when arguments are given that sound very simplistic, people tend to just throw them off. But he goes through that, and I'll leave that to you to read that in your spare time. But so that's the proof, or that's one of the proofs that are brought for God's existence. And really, going back to the Rambam, which we brought in a much shorter way, that is really what the Rambam says that Abraham did. Abraham looked at the sun, moon, and stars, didn't understand how all these things work together so perfectly, and came to the conclusion that there must be one force behind it all that's controlling it. Let's end off with the final aspect over here. Why is this so important? Why is monotheism so important? You know, this is all about foundations of Judaism. So maybe Judaism is just a nice way of life. In other words, it could be, you can live a moral life according to the morals of Judaism, the Ten Commandments, let's say. Why is the fact that there's one God so important? Why is that so essential? Besides the fact that it's true, that's the fact that is just the fact that there's one God. But why is that so relevant? Why are we putting such emphasis on that? Why are we calling that a foundation of Judaism? And I'm sure there's many answers to that question, but just briefly, two points. Number one, and we'll get into this point a little bit more when we talk about, again, Torah from Sinai and the divinity of Torah. But what's special about Torah, the morals based on the Torah, is what we call ethical monotheism, which means that the values that the Torah give are not subject to human intellect, are not because I decide that it's good or bad, because I decide that killing is bad and stealing is bad and giving charity is good, rather because that's what God decided. Okay? And that's important and vitally important for Judaism. Because Judaism is not just a set of morals, it's a set of morals given by God. And the reason why that's so important, very briefly, is because if it's given by a human being can change them. A human being decided killing's bad, a human being can decide killing is good. Who are you to argue? I say this, you say that. We're both human beings, we're both on an equal level. My intellect says this, your intellect says that. Who says who is right? Only if there is a force above both of us, God, who commands that commandment, only then can the commandment be eternal and 100% true. Okay? Now, again, we'll discuss that a little bit more when we get into the truth of Torah. But a second aspect to all of this is that having a second God, and this is more of a practical lesson from all of this, having a second God doesn't only mean serving the sun, doesn't only mean serving another God, and it doesn't only mean serving the sun, the moon, and the stars. There are many gods. There's money, right? There's work. There's many things that people make into gods. In order to have a Jewish life, which Jewish life means somebody who's focused, somebody who lives with morality, someone who lives with purpose and meaning, there can only be one God. Somebody who serves work and is just, that is his entire life, cannot properly, at least, be a Jew. Somebody who worships money cannot have a focused and meaningful life. What the very foundation of Judaism is that there's one God, and that God decides what's important in life. And what God has decided what is important in life is not any of the other gods which I just described before. What's important in life is being a good person. What's important in life is doing mitzvahs. What's important in life is spreading goodness and kindness within the world, being together with one's family, raising a family. All of these things is what God decided is what's important. And therefore, practically, to live a meaningful and focused life, the idea of monotheism, more applied monotheism, that there's no other God, there's nothing else that's important other than what God decides is important, is essential to living a true, meaningful, and Jewish life. With that, we'll end part one. Continue next week. To be continued.
Thank you. Thank you.